ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It was 50 years ago tomorrow that ABBA won the Eurovision Song Contest. For the Swedish foursome, it was the result of years of hard work. But for most of the rest of the world, it was the first we'd heard of a group that would go on to become the biggest musical stars of the 1970s and are still hugely popular today because of constant revivals of their music in stage shows, movies, on TV, radio, and online as well. But how did it all happen? And how did it happen that a pop group from a non-English-speaking country like Sweden was able to conquer the world, and Australia in particular? Carl Magnus Palm wrote the definitive biography of ABBA, Bright Lights, Dark Shadows, and has known them for all these 50 years. And it's a great pleasure and honour to have Carl with us on the program. Carl Magnus Palm, good morning. Welcome to Overnights.
Good morning, Rod.
Thank you so much. Let's take us back to that night in Brighton in the UK, which we've discussed on the program, will be replayed on BBC TV on Sunday. They're going to replay the whole Eurovision Song Contest that night. How did ABBA win Eurovision that year?
Well, they won through having the best song, or at least the catchiest song. It was just, they had wanted for several years to try to find a way to reach outside Sweden with pop music, which, as you mentioned, was, 50 years ago, it was unheard of that a Swedish band would be able to do that because pop music was ruled by, the UK, the US, more or less, and maybe, the English-speaking countries, I should say, because there was some, famous acts from Australia at that time as well. But basically, you had to be a native English speaker, basically, to have a career. And their manager, Stig Andersson, he was convinced, that these songs that Björn and Benny write are just as good as the songs they write in the UK, in the US, or wherever else. So they set about trying to achieve this breakthrough. And there were a couple of false starts on the way, but they'd sort of recognized that the best window for us, the best setting for us is the Eurovision Song Contest, because in that way we can bypass everyone who thinks that, pop music from Sweden, what's that about? I don't want to, we're not going to help them. Because if they could enter the Eurovision Song Contest with a song that was good enough and a performance that was good enough, they were going to reach millions of television viewers in one go. And then you would communicate with those viewers. And then the viewers themselves would decide, wow, this is actually a great song. I'm going to go to the record shop and buy it. Mm. So that was how it happened.
So just a couple of things on that, though. Winning Eurovision was no guarantee, though, of success, overnight or ongoing success. Eurovision had been going for nearly 20 years at that point, and there had been some well-known names that come out of it, but there'd been a lot of people who had, their careers had gone nowhere. There's no guarantee that winning Eurovision means that you're going to be, well-known all over the world, was it?
Oh, absolutely not, no. What Stig Andersson had done, contrary, I believe, to many of the previous Eurovision winners, was that he'd prepared everything. He'd made sure that Waterloo was already released in all these countries that were, the Eurovision countries, so that the record was available, and that all the record companies in those countries were aware, we're going to be in Eurovision. We're going to have these crazy costumes. Our conductor is going to dress up as Napoleon. We're going to make a splash. So you have this record on your hands, do everything you can with this now. Don't miss this opportunity. So in that way, it became much bigger than it would have been otherwise. But as you so correctly pointed out, okay, you can have one hit, but after that, will anyone be interested? And indeed, in some countries, in the UK, for instance, interest died down immediately after Waterloo had been number one. Then they didn't want to know about ABBA anymore. It was like, yeah, you know, it's an old Eurovision group. We're not interested. Go back to Sweden. We're done with you.
And you so can understand that in a way, because you win Eurovision one year, that's great. There's going to be another winner next year. You've got to be interested in them. You know, by next year, last year's Eurovision winners, they're yesterday's news.
Yeah, exactly. And the type of song that came out of Eurovision was usually something, you know, or oftentimes it was a bit gimmicky.
Yeah.
And you know, flash in the pan type thing, but ABBA were quite serious about their music, and they just forged on, and because of the success with Waterloo, they were able to spend more time writing their songs or spending more time in the studio. So after a while, when they came up with songs like SOS and Mamma Mia, the international music business were able to recognize that, oh, this is more than one of those Eurovision acts. Yeah. This is actually a serious pop group who take their craft seriously.
They had tried before. They had entered Eurovision or tried to be the Swedish entry for Eurovision in 1973. They didn't win. They didn't finish second. They finished third that year. And the Swedish entry, I think, finished fifth at Eurovision in 1973. How different do you think it would have been if they had entered Eurovision and failed, or maybe if Ring Ring had won rather than Waterloo? Because as great as Ring Ring might be, I think Waterloo is a much better record. The production is better, the singing is better, everything about Waterloo is better than Ring Ring. Do you think we'd be remembering ABBA the way that we do now if Ring Ring had won rather than Waterloo?
Oh, I mean, that's very hard to say, but Ring Ring was a very catchy record, but maybe that would have been more of a sort of one-hit wonder type thing that you expected from Eurovision. And maybe they would have, even if they hadn't won Eurovision, let's say they had entered with Ring Ring, and maybe they wouldn't have won with Ring Ring. Let's assume that.
Yeah.
They would still have forged ahead, and they would have come up with a song like Waterloo, and they would have, you know, they really wanted this success, and their manager Stig Anderson wanted it more than anyone, you know, wanted it more than the four ABBA members combined, I think. So I think their talent would have found its way onto the world stage some way.
How important also was it that 1974 at Eurovision was held in Britain? Now, usually, if you win Eurovision, you get to host it the following year, but Luxembourg had won it 1973.
Yeah, they won 2 years in a row. They won 1972 and 1973, so they couldn't very well host it again. They couldn't afford that. So Britain stepped in, and I think it was a good thing that it was hosted by the British, because that meant that the group was on British soil. So after they had won, they could travel to London, do lots of press and stuff, and be on Top of the Pops, which for our younger listeners, you know, that was the main pop program, TV program in the UK at the time. It was very important to be seen there if you wanted a hit single.
And so they were able to really strike while the iron was hot. And it was a different scoring system in 1974 as well. They won with only 24 points. and beat, amongst others, into fourth place Olivia Newton-John. And Long Live Love was a big hit for her. That only finished fourth. I mean, it's quite possible that she could have won. In the past, Cliff Richard had been a contestant for the UK. The UK took it very seriously. It wasn't like Sweden or ABBA won, you know, against not much competition. That was a pretty good year, 1974, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I know Olivia Newton-John herself. She hated Long Live Love.
Right.
But it was catchy. And I think ABBA thought that that song was going to win, or the Dutch entry, I See a Star by Mouth and McNeil. But there were, yeah, you know, plenty of catchy songs in that contest. And they weren't favorites to win. ABBA weren't. So it could have gone either way. But the thing is also that they, for them, the most important thing was the exposure as such. Because they knew that some of the big hits that came out of Eurovision hadn't been the winners, like Congratulations by Cliff Richard. Yeah. It ended, you know, in the second place in 1968. It wasn't a winner. Volare, you know, yes, in the late 50s, also didn't win Eurovision, but it came out of Eurovision. So songs like that have been very successful. So they knew whatever the jury might think of us, people will see us, people will remember us.
Irene Shear as well, Bye Bye I Love You. That was a hit in Australia. That was Luxembourg's entry in 1974, Olivia Newton-John. So, and the Italian who came second was also very well known. So it was a big year. They did it. But as you say, you know, they weren't able to follow up for a little while, certainly not in the UK, certainly not in Australia. Let's go back to before that, before Eurovision. How well known were all four members of ABBA prior to Eurovision in 1974?
Well, they were all stars individually in Sweden, and, you know, to some extent in the rest of Scandinavia and the Nordic countries. And with Ring Ring, even though that it didn't win the Swedish selection, it was the biggest hit of 1973 in Sweden. And Stig Anderson managed to get it released in quite a few countries. And it was a hit in some European countries. So they were sort of starting to become well known. But in terms of stardom, that was confined to Sweden.
We're talking about ABBA, 50 years since they won Eurovision, 1974. Carl Magnus Palm is our guest. So, amazingly though, Ring Ring had charted in Australia. Yes, in the top 100, at the bottom of the top 100, got to number 92 in Australia in late 1973, early 1974. So there was a little bit of interest in Australia prior to Waterloo. It wasn't like they, you know, arrived on the scene and no one had heard about them. Some people had heard about them in Australia, hadn't they?
Yeah, that's true. And Australia was one of the few countries at the time to release the Ring Ring album, you know, prior to Waterloo. In conjunction with the Ring Ring single and everything. So even on those early records, those early albums, those early songs they did, people in the international music business could recognize, or some could at least, that, okay, this is, the, you know, they know how to write a good tune. This is a group to watch.
You mentioned their manager, Stig Anderson. He's obviously instrumental to their success. He even sort of co-wrote some of those hit songs too. What drove him? Why was he so determined? What did he see in this group that did he see, in fact, that, you know, maybe worldwide fame was possible?
Well, the funny thing is that his main belief was in Björn and Benny as songwriters. He didn't envision them as performers. So it was only when In 1972, Björn and Benny said, you know, we've been doing Swedish language songs for a while now, and, you know, schlager, as they call it, European pop, light pop, easy listening type stuff. But what we really want to do is do pop music in English. So shouldn't we try to do that? And they did that together with Agneta and Frida, and they did a song called People Need Love, which became, you know, a fairly big hit in Sweden. And it was only then, I think, that they realized, or that Stig realized, well, not only do I have this songwriting team on my hand, I also have a group, you know, with two attractive ladies and who are good singers as well. So it was only then that it turned into, oh, we have a group here to sell, rather than just two songwriters.
Yeah. So after Waterloo, a bit quiet after that, but then kind of at the end of 74 and at the start of 1975, especially in Australia, ABBA just went through the roof. Why did that happen, do you think?
Well, that's the $64 million question. I mean, who knows? It's so hard to pinpoint. I think it was just they came with the right songs at the right time. I mean, you could say that about any of the other countries where they were popular. But, you know, you had recently got color TV and you had this television program called Countdown, which was like, you know, the Australian version of Top of the Pops, playing the songs that were on the chart or that were going to be on the chart. And ABBA provided these promo clips that look, you know, old-fashioned today, but they did their job at the time because they really showed the group. You could see the members clearly. They were colorful, they were dressed up, they had these hits. And for a while there, towards the end of 1975, in Australia, it just turned out that way, that you released single after single after single. It seemed to be like, oh, this Swedish group who had a hit with Waterloo a while ago, all of a sudden they're coming up with hit after hit after hit after hit. So I think it just the sheer impact of all that made it, for some reason, so much bigger in Australia than anywhere else at that time.
So the last 14 weeks of 1975, they are number one on the charts with three different songs. So after I Do, I Do, I Do, I Do, I Do, then we had Mamma Mia and then SOS. They're all number one after the other throughout that time. Colour TV, yes, as you mentioned, that is massively important because they were a very colourful group. Also, glam rock was very popular. Glitter rock was very popular at the time. And there's no doubt when you look at, you know, Waterloo and clips like that, they kind of fit into that glam rock image at that point, didn't they? Even though they were different from groups like, you know, Slade or Wizard or the Glitter Band, Gary Glitter, people like that, they kind of dressed like them. They sounded, they had that power pop sound, didn't they? You can't discount how great these songs, how catchy they were, and they jumped out of the radio as well. This is when radio made hits, I suppose. These days it's not quite the same as that. But, you know, when you hear Waterloo start, that jumps out at you. You are grabbed by it immediately, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they certainly had that glam rock thing going at the start, and they had those, you know, crazy costumes. Some of them, I think, are really beautiful. You know, the costumes that the girls are wearing in the Mamma Mia video clip, for instance, I think they are really cool. They still look really yes. cool. But also, I think was important for Australia was that ABBA had a kind of cross-generational appeal, mm-hmm. because I mean, you mentioned Slade, you mentioned all these other bands, The Sweet or whoever, yeah. but ABBA, they were, you know, if you watch ABBA the movie, which famously, of course, was filmed in Australia, you have all these adults saying, oh, you know, they're nice and clean. and even though ABBA dressed, you know, outrageously in quotes, they were nice and clean. They looked healthy. They were two heterosexual couples, and that was part of their image. So that made them even bigger, I think. You know, grandmothers, you know, when we move on to Fernando, I think grandmothers went out and bought Fernando.
We'll get to Fernando
very small children.
But I want to ask about that. We'll get to Fernando in a second. And obviously that cross-generational appeal is there. But the fact that it's two men, two women, that means that you've got both boys and girls, perhaps, wanting to be interested in ABBA. The boys and some of the girls really like those two women in the group. And the girls, maybe they looked at, Bjorn and Benny. They're not quite as good-looking as Agneta and Frida. But, like, there was something about them that appealed to everybody. And that was very, very important. You mentioned two heterosexual couples, of course. But when did they start attracting the rainbow, the gay community? When did that become a really important part of ABBA's appeal?
I don't think that became apparent until, let's say, the mid to late 80s, because by that time, all the young kids who had been ABBA fans during the 1970s, they were, you know, they were in their late teens and early adulthood, and they were going, you know, starting going out clubbing, and it became apparent that, you know, they want to hear ABBA songs. And how that happened is just, who knows? It's so difficult to pinpoint these things. If you look at historically what gay men, if we're talking about gay men primarily, what they have been drawn to is, you have, you know, tragic stars like Judy Garland or regal divas like, you know, I don't know, Barbara Streisand or whoever else, mm-hmm. and disco music and clubbing and that kind of thing. And ABBA inhabited all of that. You had your tragic chanteuses in Agneta. You had the regal diva, a bit of that with Frida. And then, you know, all the clubbing songs, you know, yes. Give me a man after midnight.
Yeah,
you know,
I would think that's a real turning point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very on the nose almost. But, and the funny thing was that the ABBA members themselves were completely oblivious to all that. They just wrote the songs that they liked and performed them the way they wanted to. And, I think to this day, they are still puzzled as to why that happened.
Let's go back then to 1976. In 1976 in Australia, of the 52 weeks of the year, 31 weeks, an ABBA single was at number one. The Best of ABBA sold 1 million copies, the first album in Australian history to sell 1 million copies. Arrival also sold, I think, 1 million copies. There was just something about 1976. They came out here on a promo tour, did a one-hour bandstand special as well. When again, they're dressed up in their beautiful finery. 1976 was kind of peak ABBA in Australia. One of the reasons that Mamma Mia was a hit in late 1975 as well is that Molly, or at least one of the people working on Countdown, you know, opened this box from Sweden with these videos in it. Looked at Mamma Mia and said, "Wow, we've got to play this." They kept playing it. Molly said to RCA Records, "You've got to release this as a single." They say, "We are not going to release it as a single." Molly kept playing Mamma Mia, and finally they did. It was number one for, 10 weeks or something. What do you think the record company couldn't see in ABBA that Molly and the people at Countdown and the people watching the show could?
Well, I think I would say that the record company was very excited by this. Their problem was that Dig Anderson and his record company, Polar Music, said, "No, we're not going to release Mamma Mia at this time. The current single is SOS, and that's the one you should go with. But the Australians, they want Mamma Mia. You got to let us release that as a single." Well, okay. If you must, and they did, And obviously, though, it became a huge success. It was, you know, that was the song that really opened the doors, all the doors, yeah, wide open.
And that's amazing because, you know, if they hadn't released it, SOS might have been number one for 10 weeks. Who knows? But Mamma Mia then becomes really ABBA's signature tune, and the movie, the stage show that eventually led to the movie, that's Mamma. It's called Mamma Mia. It's not called SOS. It's not called I Do, I Do, I Do, I Do. It's not called Fernando. It's called Mamma Mia. Mamma Mia became their, well, best-known hit, probably. It's still their best-known hit, probably, would you say?
Yeah, I think on an international level, maybe today Dancing Queen is the most recognizable song. But Mamma Mia is certainly up there in the, you know, top three or top five or whatever of most recognizable ABBA songs.
Mm. Then we get to Fernando. Fernando was number one in Australia for 14 weeks in 1976. We hadn't seen anything like that since the Beatles, since Hey Jude, which was number one for 15 weeks. At the time, people were wondering, will Fernando make it to number one for 15 weeks and equal or break Hey Jude's record? And it stayed as one of the top two number of weeks at number one for another 30, 40 years or so before Ed Sheeran broke it. What was it about Fernando? Because it wasn't like the previous ABBA sort of up-tempo power pop numbers. It was kind of a folk tune about the Mexican War. What was it about it? And it wasn't even an ABBA tune. It was originally recorded by Frida.
Yeah, that's right. Frida was recording a solo album. I mean, that's the funny thing about the first few years of ABBA was that they were, while they were doing ABBA, they were still, you know, continuing their solo careers. Agnetha and Frida did. Bjorn and Benny were producers at Polar Music and produced these other artists, and they had committed to doing a solo album by, you know, with Frida, which Benny produced. And he, you know, they felt, okay, so it's all these cover versions, that's all good and well, but we need something, you know, original tune as well. So he and Bjorn wrote Fernando, and she recorded it in Swedish. And I think from the moment they had recorded it with her, everyone involved felt that, okay, this is too good to remain just here in Sweden. We have to make this an ABBA track as well. And the reason it became so big is, I think, again, this cross-generational thing. It was one of those songs that, I don't know if Mull of Kintyre by Wings was big in Australia.
It was huge.
But the following year, 1977, and, you know, in the UK, it broke the sales records that had previously been set by the Beatles and She Loves You, 1963. And I think Mull of Kintyre was okay. So the pop fans bought it because it was Paul McCartney and Wings, but then you had adults and grandmothers and grandfathers and, you know, so many people buying that. And I think it's the same thing with Fernando. It was a modern pop song in a way, but you could say it harked back to the 1950s. It was the type of song that if you were, let's say, 40, 50 years old in 1976, you would recognize it, you know, the style of it from when you were young. So people who never, you know, very rarely went to the record shop, they went in and said, oh, you know, I'd like to buy that Fernando single by that ABBA group. And they did.
Interesting you mentioned Mull of Kintyre, because any comparison you can make about the success that ABBA had at this time was always with the Beatles. Most weeks at number one, most songs at number one, and, you know, sales figures as well. Mull of Kintyre was not released, I don't think, in the United States. Certainly was not a hit there. ABBA's only number one hit in the US was Dancing Queen. They're well known there. Obviously, many people have gone to see the stage show, Mamma Mia. They've seen the movie as well, or the two movies. Why do you think it is that ABBA was not necessarily as popular in the US as in the rest of the world?
Well, number one, they didn't spend enough time there. If you want to have a proper breakthrough in the United States, or at least in the 1970s, you had to go there, you had to tour there, you had to go on radio promo tours to, you know, every local radio station, show up and say hi, you know, and blah, 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 you know, interviews. You had to be on TV a lot. And ABBA weren't prepared to do that. They only did one very short tour in 1979. They went on a couple of promo visits, did a lot of television while they were there, but they would have needed to do more. And maybe it was also something about their music. I mean, they had a lot of hits there and their albums went top 20 and so on. But in the same way that ABBA were absolutely right for Australia, maybe they weren't 100% right for the United States at that time. It could have been something like that, I think.
Okay. Maybe peak ABBA happened in 1976 in Australia. In 1977, early 77, February and March, they toured Australia for 2 weeks. They played in, they didn't play in Brisbane, but they played in Sydney and Melbourne and Adelaide and Perth. Famously, it's filmed for ABBA the movie, which is a great example. It gives you a really good idea of what the phenomenon of ABBA was at the time. But after that tour, where you would think they're only going to get bigger, in fact, that's when they start ebbing away, that they only really have two hits that year. The following year, 1978, is a really terrible year for ABBA. They don't have any top 10 hits in Australia. And then they really only have a couple more top 10 hits until they break up kind of in the end of 1982, effectively. Why do you think that downhill slope happened so quickly?
Well, that was only in Australia. And I think I've sort of studied this and analyzed it and thought about it a lot in recent years. And the only conclusion I can come to is that they were overexposed, you know, times 10. There was a reporter who calculated at the time that there had been 29 television specials. So 29 ABBA television specials on Australian TV in 1976 alone. Wow. They were written about in the newspapers all the time. There were magazines, there was merchandise, T-shirts, jigsaw puzzles, mugs, perfumes, whatever. It just exploded. It was too much. I mean, this is in hindsight, of course, but if the Australian merchandising companies and the Australian TV and so on, if they had held back a bit, if they hadn't been pushing ABBA so relentlessly all the time, I think the career might have developed a bit differently.
There was everything and, you know, so much merchandise, collectible cards and all sorts of things. But, of course, they had to strike while the iron was hot. In retrospect, they were right. They needed to sell that stuff then because maybe a year from now or from a year from then, people would not have been as interested in ABBA. And that tour, as memorable as it was, yeah, it kind of was interesting that it was the beginning of the end. I wanted to ask you about this wholesome image as well. And one of our texters says, I have to laugh about ABBA being clean. They sang songs about drugs and sex, and you only have to listen to the lyrics to realise that they're cleverly crafted songs that use metaphors to disguise what they're really singing about. He says that Tiger was about heroin, Nina Pretty Ballerina was about a stripper. What do you think about that? How wholesome were ABBA, and what were the songs really about?
I don't think I've ever heard that theory about Tiger being about heroin. I don't think they were singing about heroin. Maybe, or you know, someone could make that interpretation if they wanted to, but I don't think they had that any such inclinations, or that was what they meant to do. Certainly ABBA's songs became sexier later on during the second half of their career. They were more overtly about, you know, give me a man after midnight and all that, and Voulez-vous, which is about, you know, nightclub flirting and so on, things like that. but I think their lyrics were pretty much what you see is what you get. That's my take on it. But hey, if there's someone out there who wants to think that Nina Pretty Ballerina is about a stripper, who am I to, you know, argue against that?
Tiger, the city is a jungle. You better take care. Never walk alone after midnight. If you don't believe me, you better beware. I'm behind you. I always find you. I'm the tiger. The city is a nightmare, a horrible dream. Some of us will dream it forever. Look around the corner and try not to scream. Yellow eyes glowing like neon lights. The spotlights of the city nights. The city is a prison. You'll never escape. You're forever trapped in the alleys. Look into the shadows and you'll see the shape. How wholesome were ABBA, though? I mean, they were married to each other. They were on tour all the time. I don't know what the groupie situation would have been like, but I don't think much would have going on because they were with each other all the time. Were drugs involved as well?
As far as I'm aware, they weren't into drugs at all. They liked a drink or two or three or a bottle, you know. I think that was their poison. And certainly in recent years, both Benny and Bjorn have come out as alcoholics, you know, and they're sort of recovering alcoholics. But I don't think, I mean, they say they never tried cocaine or anything like that. And I believe them when they say that, because there's no reason to lie about that now, so many years later. The whole thing with groupies and things like that, Bjorn and Benny had already been through that phase in the 60s, mm-hmm. when they were, you know, huge stars in Sweden with the bands they were in then. So they had already got that out of their system. As you say, they were in relationships. They were, you know, Bjorn was with Agneta and Benny was with Frida. Why would they, you know, go out chasing groupies? You know.
ABBA's sound changed very much by about 1979 with things like Voulez-Vous. Became this kind of Euro disco sound. You mentioned Gimme, 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 A Man After Midnight. That's certainly, you know, that sound. Did they pioneer it? Did they just realize what else was going on and that they thought, well, we've got to remain contemporary. This is kind of the sound that we want to develop. I mean, what happened there? Well, they moved on from the sort of power pop of the early 70s to a much different sound around about 79, 80.
Yeah, they were. I mean, they were always moving with the times. And then they, you know, they had their ear to the ground, and they were excited by disco. They were excited by the Bee Gees and the Saturday Night Fever songs, you know, like saying Live at Night Fever and all that, Donna Summer, whatever else was going on. And then they took those influences and then they sort of transformed it into their own thing. You know, I mean, they had like real American session musicians playing the backing track on Voulez-Vous for the first and only time, like, you know, like real disco session musicians. And I interviewed one of them at one point, and he said, you know, that guitar riff that starts in Voulez-Vous, you would never hear that on an American disco record. So ABBA took those disco influences, but then added their own, you know, peculiar little quirks to it so that it became, you know, disco ABBA style, if you will.
Their last album, The Visitors, it's different really from every other ABBA album, even the ones around about that time, like Super Trooper and Voulez-Vous. And the title track is about Soviet dissidents. And the Cold War was very hot at that point because Reagan was president, just been elected. There was a lot of changes at the top of the Soviet communists as well, with various people dying, Brezhnev and Chernenko around about that time, that sort of thing. Tell me about that song in particular, The Visitors, because no one was writing songs about that, let alone a group that was known for its pop and disco numbers.
Right. I mean, it was all part of ABBA's development. You can see if you if you listen to the final few albums, you can see, okay, the lyrics are becoming more personal, and then okay, they're becoming just slightly political, like on Super Trooper, the album preceding The Visitors. There's a song called The Piper, which is about, you know, fascist threat with a common leader, like things like that. And then on The Visitors and on the title track, it is very much about the Cold War, and it's Bjorn, you know, who was always politically interested but didn't speak so much about it in public. And like, you know, he told me that he was imagining what it would be like to be a dissident in the Soviet Union at the time, and having these secret meetings with other dissidents, and then suddenly there's a knock on the door and they realize, you know, they found me out, the KGB is here, and they're gonna, you know, ship me off to Siberia, and the panic and the terror of all that. So yeah, it's an amazing development if you think of going from Ring Ring to something like The Visitors. But it was just, it was more and more that they wanted to develop, to take new steps musically and lyrically.
Yeah, absolutely. And even the title track of Super Trooper, which is normally, I suppose, about a spotlight, that's the type of spotlight, it's about the problems they have on tour and of being in the glare of publicity. It's one of their greatest songs, isn't it, Super Trooper?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's a classic pop song, isn't it? And yeah, you know, Bjorn had that title, Super Trooper. Okay, so it's a spotlight and it sounds good when you sing it, but how do you write lyrics about it? So he came up with this thing, okay, so someone's on tour and it's kind of boring, and it's, you know, it's lovely to be on stage, but it's kind of, you know, dull life being on tour. But hey, tonight you're in the audience, and that makes me feel so good. So yeah, there was some personal resonance there, because he had experienced that with his new wife or girlfriend, as she was at the time, Lena. She had come out on their most recent tour. She had come to the UK to the United States and so on to be with Bjorn. And it meant something to him. So some of that sort of found its way into those lyrics.
Yes. We're not playing any music, or not a lot of music this morning. We'll play a little bit in a moment, because we've got 2 hours of it on Sunday morning as we tell the story of ABBA. Carl Magnus Palm is our guest. How controlling are they, Benny and Bjorn in particular, about their music and about their image? That Hung Up by Madonna, of course, samples Gimme, 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 but that's a very rare song in sampling ABBA. Now, you would think that the riffs that they came up with would be brilliant to be sampled, but they don't really allow it. How controlling are they, and why do they do that?
They are very controlling for a number of reasons. One is, I think that they feel that, you know, what's this sampling thing all about? Go and create your own music, come up with your own musical ideas, your own riffs, instead of taking from someone else. It goes against everything they think that musical creativity should be about. They, you know, write new songs instead of sampling ours. So I think the reason they said yes to Madonna was that, I mean, they liked the track. They thought the track was good, but it was also someone who had already proven herself to be a star on her own merit, so to speak.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, we'll take an ABBA track and I'll have a hit, because she was already capable of having hits. So I think they felt, and also, you know, maybe they were a bit flattered as well that someone, you know, a big star like Madonna, yes, wanted to sample ABBA. But apart from that, there are one or two examples, other examples where they've said yes, but no, they're very protective. They think, you know, go and create your own music instead of sampling us.
Fair enough too. You know, after the Beatles broke up, John and Paul did not work together again, but after ABBA, well, took a break. They never really broke up. They took a break. for 39 years before the last album came out. But Benny and Bjorn kept working together, whether it be Chess or, you know, working to help eventually develop Mamma Mia, the musical, they were part of that. That's remarkable in itself, isn't it? I mean, have they worked with other people?
Yeah, they have written and produced songs and albums for other people occasionally, and they've written these musicals, you know, Chess together with Tim Rice and things like that. But well, I guess your question was really, has Benny worked with someone else than Bjorn? Yeah. And Bjorn with someone else than Benny? And yes, they have occasionally. Bjorn has written some lyrics for, you know, a handful of other composers. And Benny has worked with other lyricists from time to time. But they keep coming back to each other because it's just... You know, I think Benny feels safe. If Benny hadn't gone on writing music, I don't think Bjorn would be writing lyrics these days. So for Benny, he feels safe with Bjorn. He knows that he will get something out of Bjorn. He will get lyrics from him that he likes and that he feels are appropriate for the tune that he has written.
What do you think, or what did you think, of the album when it was released in 2021, the song I Still Have Faith in You and Voyage? What did you think of that?
It's hard to say. I think it was a good album. Did I feel that it was an ABBA album, as I think of an ABBA album? Maybe not. There was a song on there called Don't Shut Me Down. I think that was the closest they came to the real ABBA feel. For the most part, I felt it was modern style Benny Andersson music, the type of music he writes today, but with Agnetha and Frida singing instead of these other artists he works with. So not a bad album at all. Maybe not a proper ABBA album emotionally for me.
Okay. Look, when we, you know, knew we were going to talk to you, asked you to suggest a couple of songs that you liked or your favourite ABBA songs. You chose two sort of unusual ones, or at least that I didn't expect, and which were very late in ABBA's career. One was called The Day Before You Came, which is a well-known song, and the other one is Our Last Summer. Let's start with a little bit of Our Last Summer and then tell us why you chose that.
The summer air was soft, warm, the feeling right, the Paris night did its best to please us. And strolling down the Seine, we had a drink in each cafe.
So very much like some ABBA songs, there's a great feeling of nostalgia and wistfulness about that song. What is it that you like about it? Why choose that one?
Well, I'm glad you said wistfulness, because that's what I hear in this. I mean, this was recorded around the same time as The Winner Takes It All, which is sung by, you know, the lead vocalist by Agnetha, and it's a very famous song. But this song should have been equally famous, I think. It's Frida on lead vocals, and she could do wistfulness like nobody else. The lyrics here are actually based on reality, because it's a memory Bjorn had from when he was a teenager in his late teens. He went to Paris to visit a girl, a Swedish girl he was in love with, who was working as an au pair there, and they had like a romance there. So he built on that memory for this song that also looks back on wistfully on a romance in Paris. And Frida, her interpretation of this is, even when she signs, you can hear there's some kind of regret in there. And I don't know how she did that, but I just think her vocal performance is astounding. And I mean, the song as such is wonderful. And I'm glad that it's in Mamma Mia now, because I think it's become much more well known because of that, because it's received exposure in such a big production.
The sound of The Day Before You Came is very much of ABBA at that time. Yeah, a little bit of The Day Before You Came. So it's got that electronic sound of late ABBA and the sort of boring sort of day-to-day lyrics of, you know, it's just a description of what someone's doing that day. Why that one? Why choose that one?
Well, it was the very last song they recorded, and I think it's just, it's one of the best they ever did. It's just such a masterpiece. And I think, it's nice to hear it on the show, because we've been talking about Waterloo. And again, you know, the contrast, this is the same band that did Waterloo and Mamma Mia. And now they're doing this. It's just the ABBA's development is just astounding. And these lyrics about, you know, I did all these boring things the day before you came, before she had this encounter with a man, and this kind of it could have been overblown, it could have been overly sentimental, but because of the arrangement and these synths that are sort of going there, you know, in the background, it kind of tightens it up. So it's just teetering on the edge of overblown melodrama without ever really going in there. And that's so hard to accomplish, but they did that. It wasn't a big hit at the time. I think it went to number 48 in Australia. It went to number 32 in the UK. So it was a bit of a flop, but it's become more popular over the decades. I think it's much more well regarded today than it was at the time.
And you can say that about a lot of ABBA's music, that as popular as they were at the time, these days people now realise what songwriting geniuses Benny and Bjorn were and what fabulous singers Anita and Frida were as well. They're bigger than ever, really. We've got Mamma Mia, the show. We've got the show, the Avatar show in London, the ABBA World Exhibition. Thank you so much, Carl Magnus Palm, for taking us through the last 50 years of ABBA. It's something we really appreciate, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Rod. I really enjoyed it.
Carl Magnus Palm, Bright Lights, Dark Shadows, the name of his great book about ABBA.
ABC Listen, podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.